Time for Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt joining us to talk about, a book that we've actually conversed about a couple of times here. It's called Here's the Pitch, The Amazing, True, New, and Improved Story of Baseball and Advertising. We're joined by the author of this terrific book, Roberta J. Newman. Roberta, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It is a fascinating history of, both the advertising industry and our national pastime.
Hi, thank you. I'm fascinated by the topics, too. I can't seem to leave them alone.
One of the things, Roberta, that I really liked about the book is that it's something that I think we know, but you really made it clear. You start out as a product that wants an image, and that image is the baseball player. And then as the baseball player endorses a lot of products, then the baseball player becomes his own brand. And that relationship, I thought you spun really well. If you could explain for our listeners how that really began, I think it would be really helpful.
Well, I think you can go back fairly early, and you'll find that these product endorsements by players aren't that common. It's not until the teens and the 20s that product endorsements by players became central to building their brand as well as the brand of the product. And I'd say the first major product endorser was Ty Cobb. And the way this worked, and let's remember, first of all, Ty Cobb's image is flexible. We don't really know who he was. Al Stump gave us a picture of a violent bigot, and more recently we've come to discover that Ty Cobb was in fact not the person Al Stump portrayed him to be. Nevertheless, the public at that point had no idea who he was. And by choosing his endorsements, he built his own brand by then consuming or using the things that he endorsed. The consumer could then partake of that brand, almost become, to misquote another endorsement ad from another sport, to become like Ty. And it goes back, so I would say you find a few for patent medicines, mostly for Coca-Cola, which Cobb was involved with. So I think if you want to look back to the earliest campaign where you see a big connection between baseball and advertising in terms of endorsement is Coca-Cola.
And was it Babe Ruth in working with Christy Walsh that really revolutionized the relationship between commerce and the game of baseball?
Well, I would say personally, yes, because Christy Walsh was an advertising executive. He came from the world of advertising, and he really understood how to maximize his clients' presence, media presence. He chose for them, and he chose well, and he managed their media presence. And, of course, nobody was a bigger client of his than Babe Ruth, although he did have other clients in terms of being a ghostwriter.
One of the things that happened early on is a lot of these images were originally used without the athlete's permission.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that a lot of our sort of truth in advertising laws that we have, whether they're being well enforced or not, really start there?
Well, you don't actually see athletes having control over their own image by law until the 1960s, though there were enough lawsuits to prevent this from happening in a more widespread way. So I think you can't really point to that exact time, though star players did have lawyers, et cetera, but you can see their images plastered all over things that they have no control over. I'm thinking about Jackie Robinson and how his name and image was used constantly in the black press where he got no remuneration for it. So you don't really see that control, and in fact, truth in advertising laws enforced until the 1960s.
One of the other things about the early intersection between these two things, I think, which you just hit upon, was how incredibly important it was for Negro League operators to have a strong presence and strong help from the Defender and the local black newspapers and the like. Could you speak a little bit to that?
Well, absolutely. In some cases, the black newspapers had, if not an ownership stake, then a very real community stake in the teams. The papers were their primary organ to get the word out, other than, in some cases, sound trucks, placards, word of mouth. They received a lot of, or they bought a lot of advertising space in newspapers. And you have situations like the Philadelphia or the Darby. They were called the Stars. They had a number of different names. But they were owned in part by the Philadelphia Tribune. There was a very close connection between the two. They weren't owned by the Tribune, but they had that kind of financial stake in it, rather. And you can see this because black baseball was kind of we might call it I hate to use the term fly-by-night, but it was kind of like a fly-by-night industry. Teams started, teams stopped, seasons were canceled, people were all over the place. They were very much buffeted by financial conditions in the communities they served, and the papers were their strongest defender, I would have to say. They were big supporters.
One of the things that you mentioned in the book is how, in a way now, it would be far more difficult for someone, unless you're a Michael Jordan, to be sort of a spokesman for a number of products that are nationwide, that are not just in the market that the ball player's in. How has that changed?
Well, baseball is really a fundamentally local sport. And, I mean, there are some teams with nationwide following, the Red Sox, the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Cubs, I would say pretty much. And you will occasionally see their stars pitching nationwide. But it's a fundamentally local sport, and so the market is fundamentally local. And the best way to use stars, baseball stars, is to pitch to the market that knows them. And I think you see that in that in the past, you would have one star who would appeal to an entire nation. Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Yogi Berra. It's interesting, you look at it, and they almost always come from New York or Los Angeles or Chicago, the communication hubs. And they would become major stars nationally. Here's the thing. In a lot of those cases, they didn't have to speak.
Right.
Maybe once or twice on the radio. In order to have that kind of power, a player, a celebrity, also has to have charisma. So that you could have a player like Mike Trout, who many believe, and I'm with them, is the best player in the game. He's just phenomenal, yet he's not charismatic, so he won't attract the big advertisers. And I think that you can look at advertisers and products from smaller markets and see that they can use players. I think the two most recent exceptions to that were Derek Jeter and David Ortiz, but they had the rare charisma that you might not see in players. So I don't know that it's done having that big national star. I just think there's nobody right now who represents the sport in that kind of overarching way.
We're talking with Roberta Newman about her terrific book, Here's the Pitch. Owners were reluctant to have radio and then television become a part of the broadcast, but then everybody saw that there was great money to be made from this and promotion as well. One of my favorite stories in the book is, I think it was the makers of Chesterfield would show fans in the stands during the game enjoying the game and talking about the cigarettes, but they had to stop doing that because of what the camera often caught along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chesterfield sponsored some broadcasts, and they would go live and pan shots of the crowds. However, on several occasions, they would focus on fans enjoying their cigarettes who weren't necessarily there with their wives or husbands. And so this had to stop. It was bad for business.
You also pointed out, and I hadn't thought about this, that even back in the beginning of TV broadcasting, if you were part of the broadcasting advertisers, they would show your picture on the outfield wall, but if you weren't, they would aim the camera so you didn't get seen.
That's right. If you think about it, outfield advertising is the perfect place for free advertising on television because you've got the camera and you've got to see the ballpark. And very early on, the stations who really owned the broadcasts understood that if an advertiser wasn't one of their sponsors, they didn't want to give them free airtime. I think it's really interesting now when you see the ads flip behind home plate that are there very specifically for the television cameras. And I think there must be a financial relationship between those advertisers and the broadcasters.
When you look forward and you see where we're headed, do you see any major changes in this relationship, or do you see it pretty much status quo?
Well, I think that as long as baseball remains healthy, you'll keep seeing this commercial interest in it. I do think that with new technology, there'll be new forms of advertising. And you can see it already with Instagram, for example, where fans follow players' Instagram feeds. And those Instagram feeds say if the player's endorsing something, you'll see it on the Instagram feed. Or if you follow a team, advertising will pop up on those Instagram feeds. On Facebook, most certainly. And I think that as social media becomes the dominant form of the dominant advertising medium, that you'll see more of a development of baseball related advertising heading in that direction, like everything else in the business.
Well, it's a fascinating and entertaining read. Here's the pitch, the amazing, true, new and improved story of baseball and advertising. Roberta Newman, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Oh, you're welcome.
13 minutes to go before the top of the hour. Bruce, what's coming up next week on Sports Lit?
We will talk to Steve Overman about a book you and I have both talked about, Sports Crazy. And when we first talked about it, we ended up doing two consecutive segments on it. So I told Steve to be ready for it, but he's looking forward to talking to us about it. For those who don't remember, it has a lot to do with, are youth sports headed in a good direction or are they not headed in a good direction? Mm. And we don't think necessarily they are, but we'll find out.
And in a couple of weeks, we've got a local author joining us.
Yes, we'll have Dale Wheaton on the first Wednesday in June. And then we'll get a live report from France. First time we've done it from France.
Wow.
Angie Abdu and Randall Maggs and others are planning to join me, and we will call in from Limoges, France. And I think we'll record one more before then, and then we may miss one in June.
Well, do we have to do it? Summertime, right?
Yeah.
It will be here eventually.
Yes, it will be here eventually.